and I've had to correct them several times.
So, anecdotally, and maybe you're dealing with the wrong doctors, Juan.
And at the end of my interaction with them, they've ended up agreeing with me. They have no clue. They have a set of knowledge and ideas in their minds that they learned in school and college and university.
Right.
But there's a lot of research that is a lot more up to date than what they think.
Now, of course, any good doctor is staying up to date on the research, of course. And in my experience, when I mention to a doctor, hey, you know, I recently read about X, whether it's in dermatology or whatever, they say, oh, yeah, I'm familiar with that. So the idea that doctors know less than Juan because they go based on what they learned in medical school 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago, but Juan is doing internet research. This is the height of the type of arrogance that got us the ivermectin stuff, nebulizing hydrogen peroxide, et cetera.
I think healthcare needs to be abolished.
Wow.
And totally built from the ground up.
So anyway, listen, guys, we're up against some pretty serious stuff. And with not a shred of irony, confidently, Juan saying the fact that he looked stuff up on the internet and knew more than his doctors, I guess, is evidence that the medical field is bad. I mean, it's crazy. It's really, really crazy. And this is what we're up against. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Joe Biden is facing a squeeze on defense spending from the left and from the right. It's very interesting politically what's going on. Tennessee is trying to find a loophole in order to be able to ban same-sex marriage. The problem is they might legalize child brides in so doing. It's bonkers what's going on there. And we'll talk about Alex Jones facing jail time at this point. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com to get instant access. Go to davidpacman.com/free membership to request a free membership. And anybody who wants can gift memberships to others by checking the This Is a Gift box when signing up at joinpacman.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope that Talk comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
...24 years ago, there have been over 200 attempts to get legislation enacted. But we finally stand here today, generations later, to witness this historic moment of President Biden signing the Emmett Till anti-lynching bill into law.
The historic signing of the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act culminates more than a century-long fight to make lynching a federal crime. We'll get response from the cousin and best friend of Emmett Till. Reverend Wheeler Parker was there when his 14-year-old cousin was abducted. Till was then brutally tortured and murdered in Mississippi in 1955. We'll also be joined by Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, the legendary anti-lynching journalist. Then, YouTube deletes the entire archive of Chris Hedges' Emmy-nominated television show On Contact, which he hosted on RT America, a news channel funded by the Russian government. We'll get an update from the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist about what happened. Hedges is just back from the wedding of imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
A society that prohibits the capacity to speak in truth extinguishes the capacity to live in justice. And this is why we are here today. Yes, all of us who know and admire Julian decry his prolonged suffering and the suffering of his family.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia has accused Ukraine of carrying out an airstrike on the city of Belgorod in what appears to be the first Ukrainian air raid on Russian territory since Vladimir Putin ordered his troops to invade Ukraine 6 weeks ago. A regional governor said two workers were injured in the attack on a fuel depot, which triggered a huge fire that forced evacuations in parts of the Russian city. In southern Ukraine, the International Committee of the Red Cross said it's traveling to the besieged city of Mariupol to ensure safe passage for civilians who want to leave. It's not clear if the latest evacuation attempt is succeeding. Previously, Ukraine accused Russian troops of firing on civilians attempting to flee Mariupol. In northeastern Ukraine, a Russian missile struck a gas pipeline in a residential district of Kharkiv on Thursday, scorching nearby businesses and cutting off fuel supplies to tens of thousands of people. This is Vera, a Kharkiv resident who survived a Russian attack on her neighborhood.
Our apartment block was hit by three missiles. All apartments in one area were on fire. People were left without entry doors. Where are we supposed to live? We have been here since March 6th, I want you to know. Look at us. Look at my clothes. That's how we live.
In northern Ukraine, Russian troops have left the decommissioned Chernobyl nuclear power plant, site of the world's worst nuclear disaster in 1986. Ukrainian officials say Russia formally agreed to hand back responsibility for protecting the contaminated site to them and claim Russian troops near the plant suffered acute radiation poisoning after they were ordered to dig trenches in highly radioactive soil and in an area of the Chernobyl exclusion zone known as the Red Forest. In Kyiv, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky fired two top security officials, accusing them of being traitors to Ukraine. President Biden has ordered the National Strategic Petroleum Reserve to release 1 million barrels per day for the next 6 months in order to drive down the cost of fuel. It's an unprecedented release from the U.S. stockpile, representing about 5% of all U.S. demand. Biden also warned U.S. oil producers they could face fines if they don't pump on land they've leased from the federal government.
Right now, oil and gas industry is sitting on nearly 9,000 unused but approved permits for production on federal lands, or more than 1 million unused acres they have a right to pump on. Families can't afford that companies sit on these their hands.
In response, the Center for Biological Diversity said Biden's moves, quote, will only deepen our dependence on fossil fuels and open the floodgates to more oil and gas extraction when we should be going in the opposite direction, they said. Biden also accused U.S. oil companies of raking in record profits while gouging consumers at the gas pump. A new report by Oil Change International projects U.S. oil and gas companies could collect as much as $126 billion in windfall profits this year. Greenpeace activists blocked the transfer of 100,000 tons of Russian oil between two supertankers off Denmark's northern coast Thursday. Activists in kayaks joined swimmers in heavy protective gear who braved frigid temperatures to place their bodies in between the two giant ships in an act of nonviolent civil disobedience.
I would like to inform you that we are conducting a peaceful protest, and we have swimmers and kayaks in the water on the starboard side of the Pertamina Prime. You cannot proceed with berthing alongside the Pertamina Prime. There are people in the water.
The activists painted "Oil Fuels War" in English and "No to War" in Russian on the hull of one of the supertankers. Greenpeace says Russian fossil fuels continue to arrive at European ports despite pledges by countries to halt imports. In a statement, the group said, quote, "It's clear that fossil fuels and the money flowing into them is at the root cause of the climate crisis, conflicts, and war, causing immense suffering to people all over the world," Greenpeace said. A United Nations donors conference for Afghanistan raised barely half of its $4.4 billion goal Thursday, as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned the nation's already dire humanitarian situation is worsening.
Some 95% of people do not have enough to eat, and 9 million people are at risk of famine. UNICEF estimates that 1 million severely malnourished children are on the verge of death without immediate action, and global food prices are skyrocketing as a result of the war in Ukraine.
It's the second UN donors conference to come up short of its goal this month. Aid groups continue to demand the Biden administration and European leaders release frozen reserves from Afghan Central Bank, warning that without the funds, Afghanistan faces total collapse. Amnesty International says it's concerned about possible human rights violations in El Salvador as the government enforces a brutal 30-day state of emergency that's temporarily suspended several constitutional protections. Amnesty issued an open letter to the Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele, who said this week over 3,000 people have been arrested, accused of being in gangs. Salvadorans continue to denounce police abuse. This is the mother of a person recently detained.
I think the only thing the president wants is to show big arrest numbers so that people applaud him. But there are innocent people in that prison, people who have done nothing wrong. Indeed, they have also locked up gang members. I won't deny that. But the majority are innocent people.
Pope Francis has apologized to First Nations communities in Canada over the Catholic Church's involvement in Canadian residential schools. Some 150,000 Indigenous children were ripped from their families and forcibly sent to the schools where they faced psychological, physical, and sexual abuse. The schools were opened between the late 1800s and 1990s, funded by the Canadian government and run by the Catholic Church. This is Pope Francis speaking today from the Vatican.
I also feel shame. I have told you, and I will tell you again. I feel shame, shame and sorrow, for the role that several Catholics, particularly those with educational responsibilities, have played in all that has hurt you, in the abuses and disrespects towards your identity, your culture, and even your spiritual values.
Pope Francis's remarks come after he met with First Nations leaders who've long urged the Catholic Church to formally apologize. Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission has documented at least 4,100 deaths tied to the schools as mass graves continue to be discovered. Back in the United States, former President Trump's son-in-law, senior advisor Jared Kushner, gave several hours of closed-door testimony Thursday to the House committee probing the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. His appearance by video link came as federal prosecutors broadened their investigation to include organizers of pro-Trump rallies that preceded the January 6th attack on Congress. The Justice Department is also looking into how Trump's allies conspired to promote slates of fake electors in a bid to overturn Joe Biden's Electoral College victory in the 2020 election. A federal judge has blocked parts of a voter suppression law authored by Florida Republicans and signed by Governor Ron DeSantis, saying racism was a motivating factor in its passage. In a nearly 300-page ruling, U.S. District Judge Mark Walker cited Florida's, quote, grotesque history of racial discrimination in voting. He added, quote, at some point when the Florida legislature passes law after law disproportionately burdening black voters, this court can no longer accept that the effect is incidental, unquote. The law makes it harder to vote by mail, limits ballot drop boxes, imposes new voter ID requirements, and criminalizes giving food and water to voters waiting in line at polling places. Meanwhile, Arizona Republican Governor Doug Ducey has signed a law requiring voters to provide proof of citizenship in order to vote in a presidential election. Voting rights advocates have called the bill blatantly unconstitutional and warn that unless courts block the law, some 200,000 Arizona voters could be impacted. U.S. citizens will now have the option to select a gender-neutral option on passport applications. State Department spokesperson Ned Price announced the changes Thursday as the world marked International Transgender Day of Visibility.
Starting on April 11th, U.S. citizens will be able to select an X as their gender marker on their U.S. passport application, and the option will become available for other forms of documentation next year.
In labor news, Amazon warehouse workers in Staten Island, New York, may be close to forming a union as early results of the anticipated election Thursday show union efforts ahead by hundreds of votes. Ballot counting at the Staten Island facility continues today. Meanwhile, a redo of the union election led by Amazon warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama, is still too close to call. There are over 400 challenge votes that could impact the outcome of that election in the coming days. The second vote in Alabama comes after the National Labor Relations Board found Amazon unlawfully interfered with the first election last year. And in Georgia, workers who clean the Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport in Atlanta have won pay increases after over a decade demanding higher wages. Their victory came as workers held demonstrations around the country Thursday. Sadia Bultum, a janitor who joined protests at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, said she and her co-workers feared for their safety on the front lines of the pandemic, even as the airline industry got a federal bailout.
We were risking our health and that of our families every day. Yet, it was the airline who were given billions during COVID. it were not for us, airport workers, the economy would not be running today.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, this week, President Biden signed the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act after more than a century-long fight to make lynching a federal crime. We'll get response from the cousin and best friend of Emmett Till and the great-granddaughter of the legendary anti-lynching journalist Ida B. Wells. Stay with us. The Saga of Emmett Till by Orbert Davis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden signed the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act into law Tuesday, culminating efforts to make lynching a federal crime that started over a century ago. The legislation was named after Emmett Till, the 14-year-old black teenager who was abducted, tortured, and murdered in Mississippi in 1955, after he was accused of whistling at a white woman in a store. Speakers at Tuesday's bill signing included Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, the legendary anti-lynching journalist.
Dan and I are honored to be here and represent our great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells Barnett, who once said, "Our country's national crime is lynching." She was born enslaved in 1862, Holly Springs, Mississippi, the same state where 14-year-old Emmett Till was lynched 93 years later. And in 1898, in response to the lynching of Postmaster Frazier Baker in Lake City, South Carolina, she visited President William S. McKinley right here in Washington to urge him to make lynching a federal crime. Since my great-grandmother's visit to the White House 124 years ago, there have been over 200 attempts to get legislation enacted. But we finally stand here today, generations later, to witness this historic moment of President Biden signing the Emmett Till anti-lynching bill into law.
14-year-old Emmett Till was brutally murdered August 28, 1955. He had been accused of wolf whistling at a white woman, Carolyn Bryant, and dragged out of his great uncle's home in Money, Mississippi, in the middle of the night, where his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, had sent him from Chicago for the summer. Several days later, his brutally beaten, disfigured body weighted down with a 75-pound cotton gin fan tied to his body with barbed wire was pulled out of the Tallahatchie River. The LaFleur County Sheriff attempted to force the immediate burial of Emmett Till, but Mamie Till intervened and paid almost a year's salary for his body to be shipped back to Chicago. There, the funeral director refused to open the box for her to view her son's corpse. "Give me a hammer," Mamie Till demanded. He relented and allowed her to view Emmett's mutilated remains. By then, the murder had sparked outrage across the nation. Mamie Till Mobley insisted Emmett receive an open casket funeral. "Let the world see what I've seen," she said. This is Mamie Till Mobley speaking in the documentary The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till about what she had seen. Her description is extremely graphic, a warning to our listeners and viewers. At the end of the expert, you see what Mamie Till wanted the world to see. Emmett Till's mutilated face.
I saw his tongue had been choked out and it was lying down on his chin. I saw that this eye was out and it was lying about midway the cheek. I looked at this eye and it was gone. I looked at the bridge of his nose, and it looked like someone had taken a meat chopper. Well, I looked at Mr. Rayner, and Mr. Rayner wanted to know, was I going to have the casket opened? I said, oh, yes, we're going to open the casket. He said, well, Miss Bradley, do you want me to do something for the face? Want me to try to fix it up? I said, no, let the people see what I've seen. I said, I want the world to see this because there's no way I could tell this story and give them the visual picture of what my son looked like.
That's Mamie Till Mobley, the mother of Emmett Till, speaking in the documentary The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till. Mamie Till's decision helped draw attention to lynching. Last November would have been her 100th birthday. For more, we're joined by two guests in Chicago. The Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr. is Emmett Till's cousin, his best friend. Reverend Parker was 16 years old when he witnessed Emmett Till's abduction from his great uncle's home in Money, Mississippi. Also with us, Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of the pioneering investigative journalist Ida B. Wells, who in 2020 was recognized with a posthumous Pulitzer Prize for her, quote, outstanding and courageous reporting on the horrific and vicious violence against African Americans during the era of lynching. Michelle Duster is an author, professor, public historian, and advocate for racial and gender justice. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., I mean, to have the two of you here together is historic. And I wanted to go to the Reverend as we just listened to your aunt, to Mamie Till Mobley, describe what happened to your best friend, your cousin, who is 2 years younger than you. If you could go back to that night in 1955, still so vivid with you, and I apologize for asking you to do this, to talk about what took place and the impact, not only on your family, but on the world.
Yes, it's kind of hard to understand what it was like in Mississippi at that time. If you didn't live there and experience it, it just seemed unreal. After the incident at the store, which was on a Wednesday, early Sunday morning, about 2:30, I heard the people talking about what happened at the store. I said, you got two guys here from Chicago and want to talk to the fat boy that did the talk at the store. And right away, having been raised, my formative years was spent in the South and I was well entrenched in the ways and worries of the South, I started praying. I said, God, we're getting ready to die. These people are finna kill us. I know people have been killed before. People had been hung down the street from my uncle lived. My daddy had to sleep with his gun overnight. Nobody came. Nothing came of it. And I knew where I was, and I just said, I'm getting ready to die. So I just started praying. And when death is imminent, you just think of all the bad things you ever done. And I knew it's not in good standing with God. So I just started saying, God, if you just let me live, I'm going to do right. I didn't call my grandfather. I knew he could not help me in Mississippi in 1955. So they didn't know what room I was in. It's dark as a thousand midnights. You couldn't see your hand before your face. And this large landowner's home, former landowner's home, and in and hear him coming. I heard him coming my way, and then they walked with a pistol in one hand and a flashlight in the other. I'm shaking like a leaf on a tree, and I closed my eyes just thinking this was it. I'm going to be shot. And of course, they went by me, and I woke up. They were passing by me, and they went to the third room. They found Emmett and baby Uncle Simeon, who was 12 years old. And they aroused him up, and I think he went to put his socks on. It was just pure hell in that room, and just the atmosphere was just thick with terror and fear. And I think he finally got his shoes on, and they left with him. My grandmother tried to pay them, and my grandfather begged them not to take him, and that was the last time we saw him alive.
I wanted to go to a clip of Emmett Till's great uncle. This is the Reverend Mose Wright speaking about Emmett's abduction. It's from that same documentary, The Untold Story of Emmett Till, directed by Keith Beauchamp.
This is Mose Wright. I am the uncle of Emmett Lewis Till. Sunday morning, about 2:30, someone called at the door. And I said, "Who is it?" And he said, "This is Mr. Bryant. I want to talk with you and the boy." And when I opened the door, there was a man standing with a pistol in one hand and a flashlight in the other hand. And he asked me, "Did I have two boys there from Chicago?" I told him I have. And he said, I want the boy that done all that talk.
That was, again, the great uncle of Emmett Till from that documentary, The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till. The story is so horrifying. The two suspects brought to trial were Roy Bryant, the husband of Carol Bryant, who claimed she'd been whistled at in the store, and the brother-in-law, J.W. Milam. Now, the amazing story that isn't often told, two brave activists from the Mississippi NAACP, Medgar Evers and Amzi Moore, had been involved since Till was reported missing, first looking for the lost boy, then seeking eyewitnesses to the murder. Despite the eyewitnesses, an all-white, all-male jury acquitted the suspects. One member of the jury said they'd reached the decision within minutes, but held off for an hour to appear as if they'd actually deliberated. Medgar Evers, of course, would later be assassinated. After the acquittal, Bryant and Milam sold their story to Look magazine for $4,000, about the same amount that Mamie Till paid to ship her dead son home, equivalent of over $40,000 in 2022, and they admitted that they had murdered him. Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., your response to the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act that has now been signed into law 70 years later. This is after over 200 attempts at getting an anti-lynching law over the last century. Your thoughts?
I have great commendations for those who had the courage and the fire and the guts and the ability to do what's right over 200 times, and these guys that stood up and did it. It speaks volumes, not only for them, but for America. It let us know that the wheels of justice grind, but they grind slow. They got the job done, and sometimes you're tempted to have bitterness. Why did it take so long? And it shouldn't have taken that long, but we appreciate and we're thankful for what was done and when it was done.
I want to bring Michelle Duster into this conversation. I mean, again, today we're joined by two historic figures. Yes, we're joined by Reverend Wheeler Parker, the best friend and cousin of Emmett Till, and Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, the pioneering anti-lynching journalist who won a posthumous Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago in 2020. That was you we just watched at the White House speaking at the signing of the act. Your thoughts today?
I echo what Reverend Wheeler said. I mean, it's just amazing. I'm Reverend Parker. Just the fact that, you know, finally in 2022, we have justice, we have laws put in place that that were fought for so long ago. But, you know, better late than never. And hopefully going forward, there will be more justice for crimes that are hate-based and racially based.
So let's talk about your great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, this remarkable figure in U.S. history, and talk about how lynching, what the original lynching that motivated her more than 100 years ago of her three friends. Talk about what happened.
Right. Well, in 1892, three of my great-grandmother's friends owned a grocery store, which rivaled the white-owned grocery store. And they were lynched because they were so successful that the other person decided to eliminate the competition. And she knew that they were not guilty of any crime. And so she wanted to, it started her investigating other lynchings to see how many other innocent people were being killed.
In 1898, over 120 years ago, in response to the lynching of another man, of the postmaster, Fraser Baker, in Lake City, South Carolina, your great-grandmother visited President William McKinley in Washington to urge him to make lynching a federal crime. This is in 1898. Can you talk to us about that moment and your great-grandmother's life before and after that moment? What was McKinley's response? I mean, it is hard to believe it is 2022 where the anti-lynching law was signed after 200 attempts.
Right. Well, when Fraser Baker, he was the postmaster in Lake City, South Carolina, which meant he was a federal employee. And at that time, that was a very prestigious job for an African-American man to have. And for him to be lynched because the white people in that community had a problem with an African-American being in that type of position. My great-grandmother went to William S. McKinley and implored him to create legislation making lynching a federal crime because the person who was killed was a federal employee, and she felt he needed to be protected by federal law.
And can you explain what exactly this law means? I mean, if someone is murdered and they are tried and found guilty, they're found guilty of murder. Talk about what the law does.
Well, by making it a federal hate crime, what it does is make it so that when a crime happens that would fall under this category, it would be investigated by the federal government and not just state and local government. And that's significant because, you know, there have been plenty of cases and examples when there are only local officials investigate a crime, then sometimes justice is not meted out appropriately.
I wanted to ask if you have a message for the three Republicans in the House, Andrew Clyde of Georgia, Thomas Massie of Kentucky, and Chip Roy of Texas, who voted against the bill.
Well, hopefully history will take care of that, and their names will be known as those who oppose this law.
And Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., do you have a message for them? 67 years after your best friend and cousin was lynched, was murdered and brutalized?
I think history will remember them, and they will be remembered in history. And I don't try to understand, I haven't heard why they voted against it. I would like to know why, but we of course have to pray for people like that. And the results, the percentage we got to turn out almost 100%, they don't even really count.
What does this anti-lynching law mean for police killings, for example, of George Floyd, of other killings like Ahmaud Arbery, the one of the people involved with his murder, was also a former police officer? Reverend Willard Parker.
Okay. You want to know what does this mean?
Yes.
Well, we know they were found guilty prior to the signing of this law. And what we see there in America, how far we've come and how much work we got to do, because that spirit is still out there. Law make you behave better, but it does not legislate the heart. And I was just so appreciative of the outcome and George Floyd case. The next day we had diversity protesting. And Aubrey down in Georgia, I could not believe that those men got life. That's not the South that I know. So we made a lot of progress. And I want to encourage everyone, don't give up. Continue to pursue using the law, not violence, not taking the law into your own hands.
And can you talk about your hope to create an Emmett Till and Mamie Till Mobley National Historic Park to honor their memories?
Yes, we are looking forward to that. We've met and we've talked with people, and I think that will happen. And I think we need those things. Some people say we're doing better. Why bring it up? Why do those kind of things? It's, if we don't do it, if we forget, we're subject to repeat and do the same thing we did before. So you need these benchmarks or signs, kind of like on the highway when you're driving. They need to post that sign every now and then and let you know what's going on. So we definitely need to get that, and I think it'll be done because we are progressing. Like I said, wheels of justice grind, but they grind very slow. So don't get impatient. Don't get discouraged. Hang in there. Ida B. Wells started it. She didn't get to see it, but her great-great-granddaughter got to see it. So we have to be in for the long haul.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And I don't know how many people realize that A. Philip Randolph, the renowned African-American labor organizer, civil rights activist, chose the 8th anniversary of Emmett Till's murder, August 28, 1963, for the March on Washington, where Dr. Martin Luther King would deliver his famous I Have a Dream speech. Thank you so much both for being with us, Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., Emmett Till's cousin, best friend, and Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, the author, professor, public historian, advocate for racial and gender justice. Michelle Duster spoke at the signing of the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act. Next up, YouTube has deleted the entire archive of Chris Hedges' Emmy-nominated television show, On Contact, which he hosted on RT America, a news channel funded by the Russian government. We'll get an update from the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist about what happened. Chris Hedges is also just back from the wedding of the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, in the maximum security prison, Belmarsh. Stay with us.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a like a marvelous child, he longs such a long way from home.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, performed by Michael Kiwanuka. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We spend the rest of the hour with Chris Hedges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's just seen YouTube delete the entire archive of his Emmy-nominated television show On Contact, which he hosted for 6 years on RT America, a news channel funded by the Russian government that recently closed down. This comes as Britain announced Thursday new sanctions on 14 more Russian entities and people, including state media organizations behind RT and Sputnik, and some of their senior figures to target those who spread President Putin's what they called, quote, fake news and narratives. RT's deputy editor-in-chief, Anna Belkina, told Reuters, quote, "With this action, the UK government has sounded the death knell for media freedom in Britain." Belkina said Britain had tried to silence both RT and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. For more, we're joined in New York by Chris Hedges, who is just back from London as a guest at the wedding of the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and his partner, now wife, Stella Morris. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But first, Chris, you wrote a piece headlined On Being Disappeared about having your RT show's archive completely deleted, saying, "If this happens to me, it can happen to you, to any critic anywhere who challenges the dominant narrative." Chris Hedges, can you lay out what happened?
There was no notice. There was no warning. There was no inquiry. It just vanished. It's not surprising. I think if you go back and look at the 2017 Director of National Intelligence report, 7 pages were devoted to RT. And while they accused RT of disseminating Russian propaganda, all the examples that they cited in that report were that RT was giving a voice to Black Lives Matter activists, anti-fracking activists, Occupy activists, third-party candidates, all of which was true. And so I think this was the culmination. We expected it. I was on your show, by the way, when they deleted Trump from the social media and vigorously opposed it, not because I ever want to read another tweet by Donald Trump, but because we don't want these opaque entities, and they know everything about us. We know nothing about them, to wield this kind of censorship. What I didn't expect when I was arguing not to delete Trump from social media was that I would so quickly be one of the victims.
So do you have any access to this archive?
Through the RT.com On Contact site is still up. I don't know how much longer. So we've copied them. So at least I'll have them. Off of YouTube, and you had hundreds of thousands of views for some of those shows. It's all gone. I want to stress that there wasn't one show on Russia. And the few times that we ever mentioned Putin or Russia was not in very flattering terms. I remember great investigative journalist Alan Naron using RT, I'm sure, on purpose to excoriate Russia for war crimes in Syria. But we broadcast it. This was a show that, if we had a functioning public broadcasting system, would be on probably late at night. I primarily interviewed authors. I'm an author myself, of course. I've written 14 books. Intellectuals that I admire, Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, Slavoj Žižek. It was erased for its content. I mean, not because it was Russian propaganda, but because it wasn't, but because there's been such a marginalization of critics of anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism. I'm a very strong supporter, very public supporter of the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, which, of course, I think was the key issue that saw my great friend Cornel West denied tenure at Harvard. The walls have just closed in, Amy. Since I began as a reporter in Central America in the 1980s, there's less and less space for those who are willing to seriously challenge and question entrenched power. I mean, you do it. Alan does it. But it's become a pretty lonely profession. And, of course, Bob Scheer, who I write for SheerPost, but he doesn't have any money. He doesn't have any advertisers. Also true when he ran Ramparts. So it's becoming harder and harder. I've gone to Substack like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald, chrishedges.substack.com. And if I can get enough subscribers, I will fund the column and fund the show. myself, but that's where we're left at. And, of course, you pioneered that model for many of us.
And, Chris, if you were on RT America right now, if it existed, if Direct TV hadn't canceled, taken RT America off, what would you be saying about Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, I denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine at the inception for the same reason I denounced our invasion and occupation of Iraq at the inception, for which, of course, I ran into conflict and had to leave the New York Times, because preemptive war under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. And I was very clear about that. Now, RT went dark 6 days later. I have a hard time believing Moscow would have allowed me to publicly embrace that kind of critique and remain on the air. I mean, I don't know. That's conjecture. But yes, I can't. It would be deeply hypocritical to lambast the United States for war crimes and not lambast Vladimir Putin for war crimes. With this caveat, the invasion of Iraq, occupation of Iraq, was based on lies and fabrications. I believe I was in Europe in 1989 covering the revolutions in Eastern Europe. This, of course, was we assumed naively that NATO would be obsolete. NATO was created to prevent Soviet expansion in Eastern, in Central Europe. I saw the leaders of Margaret Thatcher and the Reagan administration, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, all promise Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany. Then later with the Clinton administration, after 13 or 14 states now, of course, are been integrated into NATO. Clinton administration promised not to station troops. This was another violation. Russia has every right to feel threatened and baited. That doesn't justify the war crime that they committed. I mean, they pulled the trigger. But again, this kind of understanding of the historical antecedents that led to the attack on the Ukraine. You've had Katrina on here. She, of course, knows Russia very well. That's almost unheard of within the kind of cheerleading for the media, within the mainstream media.
Katrina Van den Heuvel, the publisher of The Nation. Chris, you wrote the award-winning book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. What does this war give Russia in terms of meaning?
Well, and I just read the New York Times this morning, and they're talking about Putin's approval ratings going through the roof. That's what war does. It unleashes all sorts of dark, toxic poisons, including the poison of nationalism, which we imbibed in Iraq, and I think to a certain extent are imbibing now, ignoring the two decades of egregious war crimes that we committed in the Middle East. The idea that somehow NATO is a defensive organization would be greeted with ridicule in countries like Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or anywhere else, or Libya or anywhere else. So, yeah, of course, every society is susceptible to that dark elixir. Russia's no exception. They've, of course, turned on their press and they're drinking deep from it. But we're as guilty of that sin as the Russians.
What would you say to critics that say RT America, RT, was an outlet for Russian state propaganda, which is why it was targeted for removal by YouTube?
Well, to a certain extent, that's probably true. But are we better off not hearing what Russia has to say, not understanding why they think the way they do? I was a foreign correspondent for 20 years. My job was to be culturally, linguistically, historically, religiously literate, to step into the shoes of a Syrian or an Iraqi or a Palestinian. And of course, I spent 6 years in Latin America and then later in Yugoslavia, and explain how the world looked from their vantage point, why they felt the way they did. And oftentimes, the grievances they have are very legitimate. I certainly think that Putin's complaints about the expansion of NATO have a great deal of credibility. It's just a historical fact that the leaders of the West lied to Gorbachev, lied to Yeltsin, and lied to Putin. That's just historically true. We're not a better world by shutting down these outlets and essentially living within our own echo chamber, especially when we wield the kind of military power that we do wield. And this gets into the whole collapse of foreign reporting. It's kind of gone the way of the dinosaurs. But it's extremely important, especially when you're an imperial power.
So speaking of the walls closing in and press freedom, I wanted to ask you about WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. This month, Britain's highest court rejected an appeal from Julian, who's seeking to block his extradition to the United States. The ruling means the British Home Secretary will have the final decision on whether to turn Assange over to the Biden administration. He faces espionage charges that could bring up to 175 years in prison after he published classified U.S. documents on WikiLeaks that exposed war crimes, you know, the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, State Department documents going back decades. Now, Julian Assange's lawyers argue he could face prolonged solitary confinement in a U.S. supermax prison, conditions that are tantamount to torture. Chris Hedges, you were in London last week as a guest of the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, and Stella Morris for their wedding, which they fought for in the maximum security Belmarsh prison. And I just want to play what you said outside the prison.
A society that prohibits the capacity to speak in truth extinguishes the capacity to live in justice. And this is why we are here today. Yes, all of us who know and admire Julian decry his prolonged suffering and the suffering of his family.
So that's the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges speaking last week in London outside the Belmarsh prison. In January, we spoke to Stella Morris on Democracy Now! She was at that time the fiancé of Julian Assange.
Physical health and his mental health are obviously deteriorating because he's only a man. He's a fighter. He's a strong person, a strong-willed person who believes in the work that he's done, he's aware that this is a fight that against a monumental injustice. But there's only so much a man can take.
Stella, since we've spoken, you had applied to be married, the two of you. The prison forbade that and then reversed their decision. And today, as you stood outside the new court ruling, you said, "Today we won, but Julian continues to suffer. Julian must be freed." Your final 10-second comment.
Well, you know, Julian, for every win that we get, Julian's situation doesn't seem to change. And this is punishment through process. It has to end. The Biden administration should just drop this. We shouldn't have to be taking it through the UK justice system, because this is a political prosecution that was initiated by the Trump administration, and it is causing ongoing harm.
So that's Stella Morris, now the wife of Julian Assange and the mother of their two children. Chris Hedges, if you can talk about what Julian Assange faces right now, does he have any final appeal, and why you believe he has been held for as long as he has before the Belmarsh prison, of course, taken refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy, where we interviewed him a number of times in London. He had been granted political asylum.
Well, there's been a long— let me just throw out that because UC Global, the Spanish security firm in the embassy, filmed all of Julian's meetings with his attorneys, revoking or destroying the capacity for attorney-client privilege, the case shouldn't even be in court. This has been a kind of judicial farce. Julian did not commit a crime. In fact, the people who did commit the crimes, which he exposed, have never been charged. He ripped back the veil in a way that no other publisher has done in our lifetime on the inner workings of power, whether it was the Podesta emails or Vault 7, which exposed the ability of the CIA to hack everything, our smartphones, our televisions, even our cars, or the Iraqi war logs, which you mentioned. The ruling elites are determined to destroy him. So Stella mentioned his precarious condition. Well, it's quite dire. We know. I was in London covering the court trials, or they're not trials, actually, the hearings about the extradition, and was observed pacing his cell frantically, banging his head against the wall, hitting himself in the face, hallucinating, calling the Samaritan hotline because, in his words, he thought about committing suicide hundreds of times a day. He suffered a stroke. He's on antidepressants. They haul him off to the medical wing in isolation. He's crumbling physically and psychologically, and I think that's the point. He can go back now if as expected, the Home Secretary rules in favor of the extradition. He can go back to the lower court, which blocked his extradition based on his potential for being a suicide risk and the harsh conditions in American prisons. He can challenge the other points. This is a legal dance that I suppose could last up to a year. Meanwhile, he is, of course, deteriorating. But everything looks as if it is engineered to ship him off to Gordon Kromberg in the Eastern District Court of Virginia, who's the kind of grand inquisitor. He persecuted my friend Samuel Arian for years and sent Daniel Hale, who exposed the widespread killing of civilians by the drone program, into prison for 45 months. Those of us who have followed the case closely have just watched this burlesque of it's kind of, it's more like the Lou Bianco or a show trial than it is the best of British jurisprudence, which I think is one of the reasons they make it so difficult to cover. And I just want to throw in, Amy, that there were six guests, including Craig Murray, who's probably done the best coverage of the trial. And at the last minute, the prison denied us entry, I suppose, because along with a photographer, I suppose, because it's part of making Julian disappear. There are no photos, no images of Julian other than that one in the police van. And after that, they put shutters on the windows so photographers couldn't take pictures of him. And that, I think, they didn't want us in there because, of course, we would write about it. I wrote about it anyway. Because it renders him human and I think exposes the kind of suffering, inexcusable suffering that has been visited on him and his family and, of course, his two children and his father. So it's absolutely appalling. And we criticize Vladimir Putin, as we should, for press censorship. But what about Julian? What about Julian Assange? So, it's like that kind of hypocrisy that characterizes the American ruling class and, unfortunately, much of the American media itself.
So he has been held at Belmarsh for more than 1,000 days and, of course, in captivity in the Ecuadorian embassy, because if he stepped outside, he would be arrested for years before that. If you could end by talking about what he did expose, this trove of documents for which many leading newspapers in this country and around the world, from El País to the New York Times, won Pulitzer Prizes, The Guardian.
Well, he exposed the lies that were told repeatedly about the wars in the Middle East, the 700 civilians who approached too closely to checkpoints and were all gunned down and killed, the torture, the routine torture in places like Abu Ghraib, along with the kind of corruption. I mean, for instance, in Haiti, he exposed cables that where the U.S. embassy was in collusion with the Haitian ruling class to thwart any rise in the minimum wage. I don't know what the minimum wage is in Haiti. It's probably under a dollar an hour. I think it's 33 cents or something. This is just and this, of course, sparked all sorts of. Remember the Arab Spring and the pushback against the corrupt ruling class in Haiti. It all came because of WikiLeaks. He exposed the duplicity of Hillary Clinton. Who was saying one thing to us on the campaign trail and accepting $675,000 to give three talks at Goldman Sachs, a sum so large it can only be considered a bribe. It exposed that she orchestrated the war in Libya to burnish her own credentials. So it was...
We have five seconds, Chris.
He provided the most important information I would argue, along with Ed Snowden, of our generation, and they're making sure that he's crucified for it.
Will you be suing YouTube?
Right now, I'm just trying to save my shows, but that's a good idea.
Chris Hedges, I want to thank you for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, award-winning author, and activist. Very happy birthday to Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Real vinyl.
Yeah! my